I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
From iHeart Podcasts.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
I'm Paul Pringle, an investigative reporter for the LA Times. Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, guys. Nancy Grace here, host of podcast Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. I've dedicated my life to fighting crime and helping crime victims. For a decade, I prosecuted violent felonies. Every day is a mission. Every day is a chance to stop crime and keep one more person safe. Listen to Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
Now here's a highlight from Coast to Coast AM on iHeartRadio.
The Spahn Ranch part of the movie, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, is really just, it was really creepy. It reminded me a lot of like a really good Twilight Zone episode or something. It was so much atmosphere, and so you confirmed that in fact you would have had that effect when people, you just kind of came out when there was a visitor at the ranch, you all kind of came out and congregated, and you were saying that the house where George Spahn, who owned the ranch, lived, was not up so high. There weren't that many steps.
No.
Was it as dingy and gross as it is in the movie?
You know, it was pretty dilapidated, but I mean, you know, like in the movie they show, you know, a rat caught in a trap and he's squealing and you know, it's really filthy, dirty.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that's how people think we lived, but we didn't. I mean, I think that we improved George's lot. You know, I think we improved the condition of his house. I mean, I remember cleaning his refrigerator.
Right. You're a bit of a neat freak, which I admired about you, that you said that when you would get high on acid, you actually did stuff like cleaning.
I know. It's, you know, it's still an issue these days.
Is it really the cleanliness thing?
Yeah, you know.
Oh, it's funny though, but so you said it, you know, that house needed a woman's touch. Am I right in, I mean, I know you slept, you say you took turns sleeping next to him. Did you also sleep with him? George, the old man?
I did take my turn.
Okay.
You know, like, I think we took turns. I don't know if, you know, we did intercourse, if anybody did intercourse with him, but I took my turn giving him head.
Okay. All right. Well,
yeah.
So this is the frankness of the story, as I had alluded to, that there was, but that part was a little vague and I was sort of surprised and I don't want to dwell on it, but it was interesting because this idea of all the orgies and all of this stuff, that's not a myth. It really, that was what life was like, according to your account, inside the Manson family. It's not exaggerated. It doesn't seem... It sounded like it was your new normal.
Right. We kind of did it, you know, regularly. I don't know. I don't think it was weekly. We took acid pretty much weekly. We smoked pot, you know, daily. And, you know, we maybe did the orgy loving thing, you know, every other week.
Okay.
You know, maybe every week occasionally, but it wasn't. It, you know, it wasn't a constant thing. and Charlie orchestrated it. You know, he'd pass out the tabs of acid like it was a sacrament, and then, you know, he'd kind of start taking off his neighbor's shirt, right. And then
one thing would lead
to
another.
Circle, and it was, yeah. You know, everybody took off the next person's shirt, and you know, I mean, it. So, all I can describe it is the way I experienced it.
No, I think that's.
I don't remember it being like this total wild, you know, fever pitched or, you know,
right.
Orgy. I don't remember it that way, but that's me.
Yeah,
you know, other people might view it differently.
So, but you also, at this time when you were so enamored of him and you were fully under his spell, you had also already experienced his wrath. He had hit you. He had hit you, I think, a couple of times by the time you got to the Spawn Ranch. And you didn't like that, but you were, like everybody else, you were sort of conditioned to try to make Charlie happy. And so you were very mood conscious. I thought that was a very interesting that a lot of your day, perhaps much like a lot of abusers would relate to, was spent trying to gauge the mood of the person that was abusing them.
Yeah, that's true.
So you had some clues, and I read an account that somebody else had said that you were the most hit person in the family. But I don't know that I had heard you say that in the book. Do you agree with that assessment?
You know, it's starting to come out that he hit a lot of the girls, but not publicly. So I think that, you know, he used it as a tool. I don't feel like he, like, totally took out, like, his anger or fury on people. It was more disciplinary.
But in a kind of twisted way, right? I mean, this isn't how people, right, this is...
Exactly, and that's, I mean... I remember he did slap me when we were like in New Mexico because I actually just want, you know, hey, you know, do you need some food or, you know, and he had a toothache or something and he just, you know, I spoke out of turn, whatever, and got slapped. And then, but it's not like he beat me. And then the next episode I remember is, you know, with the extension cord, I remember him
right.
kind of like winking at me, you know, like, you know, I'm making an example of you, you know, go with it, you know, kind of thing. So every time there was, you know, in my mind, you know, he had mitigated. It wasn't just, you know, I wasn't the recipient of, you know, uncontrolled rage and fury. There was a reason for it. And so I think that's why I accepted it.
Well,
it's not okay.
No. And it's
not okay. And I know that now, but this is my perspective then. You know, I try to go back to where I was then. And
you'd grown up
both sides.
You'd seen your father hit your mom, so in a lot of ways, it was a pattern that probably existed already in your mind as being a little bit as acceptable in some way.
And Charlie was, you know, he was a chauvinist. He was big on, you know, women are supposed to submit to the husband, kind of thing. You know,
so much for new thinking.
He said that, you know, yeah.
So. But in a way, falling out of favor with Charles Manson really saves your life.
Yes.
Explain how your life, your entire future pivots on the fact that he's mad at you or he's ostracizing you a little bit.
Right. I mean, I was supposed to stay in the desert, and I didn't. I came back with Bobby Beausoleil, and Charlie was furious, and the whole energy and the whole kind of the main thrust that was going on in the family at that time was totally different than I had ever seen previous. He was really, you know, he was really trying to gather supplies, you know, convert Volkswagen Beetles into dune buggies and other vehicles into, you know, dune buggies. He had incorporated the Straight Satans, which is like a motorcycle gang out of Simi Valley, into our family, you know, and they provided guns and knives and mechanic services. To convert these vehicles into dune buggies. And it just, you know, it was just like this frenetic energy to try to, they weren't doing good. And, you know, I remember he held my fingers and other people's fingers over flames on a candle. It was like, to condition us to not feel pain.
Right.
And it was just, you know, and I, from the time I left the desert with Bobby, I felt like a, kind of like a salmon swimming upstream, but not to spawn, but I was going in the wrong direction.
Yeah. In his eyes.
The rocks, the trees, everything was calling out to me that I'd made a mistake. And when I got to Gresham Street, which I didn't know anything about Gresham Street, because I thought we were going to go to Spawn Ranch, and Gresham Street was, you know, like a mile or two from Spawn Ranch in Canoga Park. And he was just furious with me. I'm taking you back to your parents. I'm going to find your parents. I'm taking you back to your parents. And he did find them, and he did take me back there. And at that point, I'd been with Charlie too long, heard too many of his songs. That's all I had going on in my head, and I just felt, again, rejected, and my parents were now, my mom had not remarried, but, you know, she and my dad had definitely separated, and, you know, she was with another man, and they were, boarding parents for an alternative high school, so they had all these other kids my same age, basically, living with them, and I just felt crazy. I mean, I wanted to jump on the roof of the house, climb up onto the roof of the house and spew out all Charlie's talks, you know, about living in a garbage dump and all. I mean, it was, I just felt crazy. I mean, I really felt crazy.
You were programmed.
Yeah, I was. Yeah. And so I went back to Charlie because I felt comfortable. But, you know, I mean, I felt in juxtaposition to being in, you know, like a more normal, you know, society, whatever, I just felt crazy. And so I went back to Charlie, and then he took me to Gary Hinman, and I lived with Gary Hinman for a week or so, and then I got Gary Hinman to take me back to the Spawn Ranch, and the family really didn't live there anymore. I think Lynette was still taking care of George in the main house, but the back house, you know, was another commune that had kind of moved in.
So
it was just a crazy, time, and eventually, apparently, Charlie took me back, but I was never part of the, like, inner circle. I was just kind of, like, hanging on, you know, to the fringe, you know, taking care of babies, doing, you know, doing housekeeping, cleaning, or whatever, but, and the other girls were going on these creepy crawly missions, and it was just a weird, everything was weird, and if I'd had my head screwed on, you know, I would have got out of there, but I didn't.
So the tragedy of Bobby Beausoleil, well, we probably won't have time for, but it, and even, you know, all the names you mention are familiar to people that know that story and know that era. Let me ask you about, so you weren't included in any way, you weren't even discussed, you didn't have to get out of any of those creepy crawly things where they committed the horrible crimes at the Tate Mansion, the Polanski Mansion, or at the LaBianca house. You weren't involved with that. When did you suspect that murder was part of the Manson family agenda? When did you start to feel like there's a much darker side to this? My fears aren't unfounded.
It wasn't until we were, I'd woke up one morning to Leslie burning some of the LaBianca stuff in the fireplace. I woke up to that, and then a car came down the road, and she said, oh, she put out the fire, and she hid under the blankets and told me to get rid of these guys that were coming down in the car down the road. She says, they just gave me a ride from Griffith Park, you know, don't let them know I'm here. So I went to the door, and I, you know, did my best to, you know, now, you know, it's just me, you know, nobody else is here. And they did leave, but then that, I think it was that afternoon that I got whisked off with another younger member, and I think Juan Flynn, I think one of the
ranch hands.
Spawn ranch hands, took me to Olancha, and then Tex was there. And Olancha is on 395. It's kind of like one of the gateways to Death Valley, one of the ways, mm-hmm. one of the main roads to get to Death Valley. And it was there that Tex got a newspaper with the headlines, and I came back into the camp, and he slaps the newspaper, and he said, I did this. Charlie told me to. And that's when I knew, oh, wow, yikes, they're capable of murder. They did murder. This Helter Skelter is not just a mind game. Because Charlie liked to play mind games. And it was real.
Listen to more Coast to Coast AM every weeknight at 1 a.m. Eastern. And go to coasttocoastam.com for more.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia, movement that inspires. Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold-Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold-Blooded, the Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
From iHeart Podcasts.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
I'm Paul Pringle, an investigative reporter for the LA Times. Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.